Call this meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:31 p.m. on Tuesday, March 3rd. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum present today, our Vice Chair Coghill, Senator Wilson, and myself, Chairman Rivak. I'd like to ask, please mute your phones in the audience. Staffing the committee today is the amazing Ms. Carrie Cooper-Ryder. From Senate Records, Jim Bridges is our moderator, and Betty Tangeman as my committee aide. Today we have a number of items on the agenda. SB 137, extend the Board of Parole, SJR 18, women's suffrage, and the committee substitute for HB 83, prohibit voting by facsimile, and SB 165, prostitution, trafficking, vacate convict. All right, let's get started with SB 137, an act extending the termination date of the Board of Parole and providing for an effective date. This bill is sponsored by Senator Michicki, and this is the second hearing on this measure. We have Chris Curtis from Legislative Budget and Audit here and available for additional questions. And at this time, I'd like to invite Mr. Michael Willis for any additional comments that you have on the extension of this board. Please come forward, put yourself on the record, sir, and begin.
Good afternoon, Chair Rivak and committee members. For the record, my name is Michael Willis. I'm interning for Senator Michicki this session. The senator regrets that he's unable to attend this hearing due to his membership in another committee. SB 137 extends the Board of Parole termination date from June 30th, 2020 until June 30th, 2025. The legislative audit, who conducted the audit of the Board of Parole, has recommended a 5-year extension as opposed to the maximum 8-year extension. The reduced extension is merely an acknowledgement of recent changes to the board statutes, which require continued oversight. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Willis. Do we have any concerns to address from committee members? Questions, comments? Yes, Senator Coghill.
I can make a comment. First of all, I wanted to thank the senator and the staff for bringing this forward, and also for our auditor, Chris Curtis, who gave us quite a walk down memory lane of our policy calls. So it is interesting that the Board of Parole has a lot of issues they're dealing with, including some that couldn't find their way into the audit because they're underway. So I think this is a good thing to pass along, and I think we should pass it along to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Any further questions? All right. Well, at this time, I'd like to ask the will of the committee for this bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
I make a motion to move the Senate Bill number 137, version 31, LS1344, version M, to committee with individual recommendations in the attached fiscal note.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Is there an objection? Seeing no objection, SB 137 moves from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Record, Up next is SJR 18, commemorating the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, sponsored by myself. And I'd like to invite Ms. Betty Tangeman to come forward and please put yourself on the record and introduce our bill.
Make sure this is working. My throat's not all that great. Okay. Good afternoon, Chairman Rivak and members of the committee. My name is Betty Tangeman, and I'm a legislative aide for Senator Chairman Rivak. I'm very pleased and honored to be presenting Senate Joint Resolution number 18, commemorating the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. The most foundational right in a democracy is a right to have your voice heard at the ballot box. Our nation is made stronger by all citizens contributing to our governance. There have been many heroes in the fight for women's suffrage throughout history, but the movement in the United States truly took form in 1848 with the Seneca Falls Convention, where eloquent speakers like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott outlined their dream of an America where the votes of women would be counted. It would take 70 years for this dream to be realized with the passage of the 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution on August 18, 1920. But it is clear that we are indebted to the countless women who made this happen. Our nation will forever be the land of the free and the home of the brave because the inalienable rights of women are eternally secured. We celebrate women's suffrage and the many trailblazers that the women's movement has and will continue to produce. Here in Alaska, a woman's right to vote was guaranteed on March 21, 1913, as the first action of the newly formed territorial legislature, a clear point of pride for Alaskans. In 1959, in the very first meeting of the Alaska State Legislature, there were four women standing as members of the body. In 2002, Alaska sent its first female U.S. Senator to Washington, Lisa Murkowski, and 4 years later, we elected our first female governor, Sarah Palin. Palin also made history as the first Alaskan to run on a presidential ticket. Today, in the 31st Alaska State Legislature, we have Kathy Geisel as the Senate President for a total of 23 female legislators, the largest proportion of women lawmakers in the state's history. The 19th Amendment reads, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." A short sentence with a profound and everlasting impact worthy of significant celebration. Thank you, Chairman Rivak and members of the committee.
Thank you, Betty. Fantastic job. Do we have any questions for members of the committee? Senator Coghill.
First of all, I thank you for this. For those of us who are not female, I can tell you most of us got here because of a lot of work of some of our female counterparts. I can tell you that. So the influence on both voting and being active in the voting realm, whether it's the League of Women Voters or partisan politics or even staffing, it's a significant portion of Alaska's history and makeup now. So it's just we're all in it together, but this is a good commemoration. I'm certainly going to be supportive of it, but I just want to say good on you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. I would just like to add that I really learned a lot and enjoyed doing some of this research and found it interesting that Alaska's very first act as a territorial government was women's suffrage, which happened. We were 7 years ahead of the curve in front of the federal government. And actually, March 21st, it was signed into law, and March 18th, the Senate, the Alaska Territorial Senate ratified the bill. So thank you very much, Ms. Tangeman. We appreciate it. I would like to invite Ms. Ann Brown, Vice Chair of the Alaska Republican Party, to come and give comments. Are you, would you like to come testify, ma'am, please? Invited.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would say that the Alaska Republican Party supports the 19th Amendment and the right of citizens of the United States to vote, and that that right shall not be abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex. We at the party support that, and we support your resolution.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Having no further invited testimony, I'd like to open public testimony. Public testimony on SJR 18 is now open. Do we have testifiers in the room? Ms. LeMaster? No? It looks like we have public testimony online. Ms. Ayala, Lopez Ayala, did I get that right? Are you online? If so, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, yes. My name is Sochi Lopez Ayala, and I'm here representing myself, and I'm a resident of Homer. I wanted to talk about SJR 18 and that there needs to be acknowledgement that not all women obtained the right to vote 100 years ago. While I applaud that you acknowledge people of color and indigenous Native women that have made achievements in our state legislature, as well as acknowledge your intention that you are here to celebrate the right to vote for 100 years, let's remember that not all women received voting rights 100 years ago, and you might be essentially whitewashing our history. Chair Rayback, being originally from Minnesota, you might not know some of our history regarding Alaska voting, so I'm here to share with you and the rest of your committee some insight and suggestions to add to this resolution. Alaska, the territory, granted women full voting rights in 1913, 7 years before the 19th Amendment. While white women in the Alaska Territory could now vote, indigenous Native women could not. Activists advocated for Native suffrage rights. In 1915, the Alaska Territorial Legislature recognized the right of indigenous people to vote if they gave up tribal customs and traditions. This needs to be included. The government silenced Native voices in exchange for voting rights and government services. Plus, it wasn't until the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which also is not mentioned in SJR 18, which secured the same right to vote for most marginalized communities across the United States. The state of Alaska needs to acknowledge the systemic oppression faced by women of color and indigenous Native women to gain the right to vote and have it be entered into SJR 18. Sacrificing their traditions, language barriers at the ballot box, unreliable transportation, or access to polling places and other forms of voter suppression, all to simply cast a ballot. It is important to note that this targeted suppression also takes place in rural communities. In 2004, 24 villages in Alaska did not even have polling places. Recognizing our past is tough, I know. Can you imagine those who experienced marginalized voter suppression because of language barriers? According to the Division of Elections, prior to 2008, the division's entire language assistance program revolved around oral language assistance through bilingual poll workers and provided some translated radio announcements in Yupik and Inupiaq primarily. After the NICS settlement in 2007, the division started providing materials, audio and written, in Alaska Native languages. In 2008, the division created the Yupik Translation Panel and made the very first Yupik glossary and began preparing written as well as audio translation of the ballot measure text in general-centric Yupik along with radio PSAs. You need to pass legislation to make voting more accessible. State officials can influence borough, county, and city officials for voting inclusion, like mail-in ballots, ride-sharing programs, extending voting rights to folks who are incarcerated, and even making Election Day as an Alaskan state holiday. If you really want to acknowledge the history of women's suffrage and voting rights, this resolution isn't going to do that without acknowledgement of our own history. One thing to be clear, I'm not testifying here today to seek reparations or for the state's wrongs to be righted. I'm here testifying today to have the Alaska legislature acknowledge our past and not whitewash our history. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Lopez Ayala. Do we have any additional testimony in the room? Seeing none online, we'll close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed. We'll take a brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. What is the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman? I think it would be a good idea to move the bill. I think some of the considerations that were brought forward may be worthy of consideration. After looking at the whereases, I don't know that we've excluded them. It's just that we didn't include them. So. I'm comfortable with keeping it on a high note, but it is true. There's some questions down through history that those are probably four or five of the questions that could be added to a number of other questions as well. So I think moving the bill forward with a simple statement is probably a good thing to do at this point because we're celebrating the right was put forward, just like many other things we've done in history. The right always took a while to take root, and that was true in Alaska. Many of us have seen it firsthand. With that, Mr. Chairman, I move that we move the Senate Joint Resolution Number 18, Version A, from committee with individual recommendations.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Is there an objection? Seeing no objection, SJR 18 moves from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. To hear HB 83, an act relating to voting by electronic transmission in state election. I'd like to invite, Representative Christ Tompkins is on the floor, so we'll invite Aaron Harrington to please come forward, place yourself on the record, and walk us through the bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Harrington, and I'm staff to Representative Christ Tompkins. I apologize that he's not here with us today. He's on the floor tending to the operating budget. Before you today, you have the CS for House Bill number 83 out of the House State Affairs Committee, also amended on the House floor. House Bill 83 is a bill that eliminates the return of absentee ballots by fax. So House Bill 83 was drafted in response to recommendations by national election security experts on steps that Alaska could take to fortify the integrity of our election system here in the state. The Division of Elections itself has taken some of these steps already, those that it was able to take just through regulatory changes and changes of practice. But House Bill 83 addresses a security vulnerability that rests presently in statute. The recommendations that are being worked from, which came out of an extended hearing that House State Affairs had last year with a number of election security experts recommended the discontinuation of electronic return of ballots to the Division of Elections. By eliminating electronic returns, you eliminate the risk of a ballot being tampered with en route without the knowledge of the voter. Fax is these days largely an electronic return, or at least it runs the risk of being it, depending on where the equipment is being used. Many fax machines are set up set up to transmit over digital systems as opposed to the old copper line systems that we may remember from the early days of faxes, and also faxes are oftentimes sent just using a simple app on your smartphone through secure or insecure ways of transmission. DOE has discontinued on its own the acceptance of ballots using their online system. And they did this for the same reason, because transit over the internet is susceptible to tampering. In addition, I will just add a note of my boss's that fax transmission is kind of outdated. So what this bill allows is for DOE to continue to deliver ballots by fax to absentee voters who request them in that manner, but it prohibits the return of those same ballots by fax. No one can return a ballot by fax who hasn't requested it in that manner, so the number of potential returned ballots is always less than the number that are requested. The bill, as it was amended on the House floor, does provide an exclusion for people who are absent uniformed service voters, also known as UOCAVA voters. These voters can continue to return ballots by fax. It's a very small number that utilize this typically, and we want to ensure that people who may be in an active area of conflict overseas but are trying to exercise their right to vote are still able to do so with the minimum amount of barriers. And for the very small number of ballots that are returned, this represents a relatively small risk in comparison to the potential benefit that it may provide to those particular voters. I think that I will pause there and see if there are any questions from the committee, or I could, and then I can dig, Mr. Chairman, with a little bit more detail into perhaps some of the numbers of people that might be affected this, or answer other questions from the committee.
I have a question, and thank you for your testimony. So does this say that you can still receive a ballot by fax, you just can't return it by fax unless you're in uniform services, is that right?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that is correct. You will still be able to receive your ballot by fax. Just returning it by fax will no longer be an option to you. So essentially you would need to mail it or drop it off in person at a voting location. And the reason for this difference, and the reason that the security concerns are less in the transmission, is because a voter receiving the ballot then has the opportunity to review the ballot and ensure that the ballot looks as they would expect it to look. Whereas on the return, once the voter hits send on that fax machine, if their ballot were tampered with in any way en route to the Division of Elections, that voter would have no way to ascertain that. So the voter themselves is the safeguard on the receiving end, and we are trying to ensure that their cast ballot is returned as they intended it.
Thank you. Senator Coghill.
Thank you. So somebody voting absentee has to apply for an absentee ballot, and they could mark from this a request to be faxed this, or it would be a digital sending basically, right? So they could either get it by a fax machine or, as you said, a PDF probably would come, or some other way that the Division of Elections would send it to that individual. So it would be a request and a send. Now, when I go voting, they check my ID and they check off. So is there a check off on those that apply for an absentee ballot to check to make sure that as many going out, we have an expectation how many might come back in.
Senator Coghill, through the chair. Yes, so ballots that are received, absentee ballots that are received, all of them are reviewed individually by the by a ballot review board. It's a bipartisan ballot review board, and that's every absentee ballot. The number of ballots that are returned, I think if I'm hearing your question correctly, and clarify it for me, please, if I'm not, but essentially you're wanting to balance the number of ballots out against the number of ballots in?
Yeah, because, Mr. Chairman,
yes,
chain of custody is something we're going to be paying very close attention to, and this will be one place where a chain of custody can be very important.
Yes. So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Coghill, Gail Fanumiai from the Division of Elections, I believe, is online to answer questions that you may have, and I think that I would defer that question to her to really get into the specifics of chain of custody issues.
Yeah. She is, and so is Noah Klein from Legislative Legal Counsel, also on the phone. Maybe we could Gail, are you online? Did you hear that? If so, could you please put yourself on the record and take a stab at that question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am. This is Gail Fanumiai from the Division of Elections. And if I understood Senator Coghill's question correctly, he had posed the question that when he goes to vote in person, he's required to provide identification. And what kind of checks and balances do we have on the absentee side of that?
Yes. Thank you.
Is that a correct
Yes.
summary of his question?
Mr. Chairman.
So before somebody can actually receive a ballot by mail or by fax, they have to complete an absentee by mail application, which requires them to provide their voter identification number, the last four digits of their Social Security number, their driver's license number, their date of birth. So there is a verification process that is done prior to that ballot ever being sent to the voter. And then there is a process when that voted ballot is, excuse me, is returned to the Division of Elections. The first check is, first of all, did that voter actually apply for a ballot? And we have that information in our voter registration system. And then the ballot is reviewed by a bipartisan board to ensure that they have provided all the required information they need to provide when returning a voted ballot, which is it has to either be postmarked on or before Election Day, or in the case of returning a ballot by fax received by the times the polls close on Election Day, it has to be signed by the voter, they have to provide an identifier, and it has to be witnessed as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
Thank you. That answered really the bulk of my question. Then the next question is, we have actually allowed some military folks to return by facsimile. Is that now, based on what this proposed law is saying, what do we do now presently? Do we just have to wait for the paper ballot to come in by mail, or is there other electronic transfers that they can do at this point, Gail?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, the only option for people to return a ballot electronically now is by fax or through the mail. So the only electronic version of being able to return a voted ballot per this bill would be if you're a uniformed overseas military member. They would be allowed to return their voted ballot by fax. Everybody else who receives their ballot either through the online delivery system or by fax would be required to return their ballot by mail. Same checks and balances are in place for either situation and how the ballot is received.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So if we did other electronic transmission, it would be really the same thing. It would be unique identifiers and a verification of some kind?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, that's correct. An application for either type of voting requires the same information.
Thank you, Senator Wilson.
Yes, I guess my question is for Gail. How many, past voters in the past couple elections have, from which communities have voted by fax?
A through the chair, Senator Wilson, did you say which communities?
Yeah, about how many voters in the state have cast their ballots by fax in the past election, and from do you know from which communities those you get the majority of those faxes from?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I have total numbers of the state as a whole. I do not have numbers by individual districts. I would have to get some more detailed reports to get that. We track how the ballot is sent to the voter. When the ballot comes back to the division, they are logged in our voter registration system, but the method of return is not logged. So when a ballot is when a ballot comes back, we just consider it as a returned voted ballot. We do not log it as being received by fax or by mail.
Okay.
So, for example, in the 2018 election year, we had seven voters being issued a ballot by fax. Three of them were military domestic, and four of them were overseas citizens. As far as the online delivery in 2018, there were 2,628 voters, UACABA voters, who applied to receive a ballot online. 181 of those were military overseas voters. 1,459 were military domestic, and 988 were overseas voters.
Just a different question.
Yeah. Senator Wilson.
So my next question would be, if you've complied with the majority of the audit's requests, how come the administration did not come forth with the solution? Is it something that we need to fix, or are we going to disenfranchise that small population of voters and from those districts by passing this initiative and passing this piece of legislation?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I don't believe a voter is going to be disenfranchised by this. They will still have an opportunity to return their ballot by mail, as is the best practices, as has been reported by agencies outside of the state that work on security issues.
Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question was, was the administration not looking to fix this through legislation themselves by submitting this request?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the administration did not put forth this bill, obviously, but the Division of Elections is more than willing and able to implement this bill as passed by the state legislature.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. Any other questions?
Senator Rebeck.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. I do want to bring one issue to the attention of the...
Can you put yourself back on the record,
yes,
please?
Thank you. Erin Harrington, staff to Representative Christ Hopkins.
Thank you.
I do want to bring one issue to the attention of the committee that came to our attention after the bill had passed from the floor. The amendment to provide the exclusion for UACABA voters was made on the floor, and what we didn't catch was that the bill, as it had originally been written, repealed a set of attestations and oaths that a voter makes when returning a ballot in this manner. Those attestations and oaths can be implemented in regulation as well. But I bring it to the committee's attention in case you would actually like to address that here. And so in the bill, what that looks like is on page 2, line 4, it's section 3 of the bill. It's a short line. AS 1520-066B is repealed, and that section of statute is the section that describes those attestations and oaths, and they're specific to the electronic transmission of ballots. And so, when this bill was originally drafted, there was not an exclusion to the Yukawa voters, and therefore there would be no remaining electronic transmission, a return of ballots. Now that there is one that remains for the Yukawa voters, it may be appropriate to not repeal that section. I do have a memo from Legal Services that addresses this. I believe that it is in your packets. It's dated February 17th. And Noah Klein, one of the attorneys at Legal, notes that it can be addressed otherwise, or it is up to you to change it here. So bring that to your attention.
Thank you, Ms. Harrington. Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, we will move on to invited testimony. We have no invited testimony. We will, at this time, open public testimony. Public testimony is now open. Is there anyone in the room or online that would like to make a statement? Anyone in the room? Seeing none, we have no one online to testify. We will close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed. We're going to hold this bill and would encourage folks to submit written testimony to the email address ssta@akleg.gov. That's ssta@akleg.gov. We'll take this up in another committee meeting. All right. Next, we have SB 165, an act relating to sex trafficking, establishing the crime of patron of a victim of sex trafficking related to the crime of human trafficking, relating to sentencing for sex trafficking and patron of a victim of sex trafficking, establishing the process for a vacation of judgment for a conviction of prostitution, and providing for an effective date. This is a governor's bill, so I'd like to invite Mr. John Skidmore, Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, to come forward to the table. Please introduce yourself, sir, put yourself on the record, and walk us through this bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of Senate State Affairs. My name is John Skidmore. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. I'd like to thank the chair and the members of the committee for allowing me to come in and address an important issue that is often underreported in our state. That's sex trafficking and human trafficking. You may not realize this, but that industry is actually the third most profitable industry for organized crime in the world. It falls behind only drugs and arms trade. In Alaska, it's difficult to determine the true extent of these crimes because they are often underreported. They're often mistaken, and we have individuals that are treated for drug abuse, alcohol abuse, domestic violence, delinquency, teenage pregnancy, STDs. Yet many of the people that are treated for these various issues are actually victims of sex trafficking or human trafficking. You'll note that many of the things I just described are things that we often encounter with young people. That's because, believe it or not, the age that someone most frequently becomes a victim of sex trafficking is 14 to 16 years old. 14 to 16 years old is the most common age for when people first become victims of this crime. They're lured with promises of protection, of love, adventure, opportunity, or even just a home. And then they are forced to engage in conduct that they otherwise would not have wanted to do so through fear, violence, intimidation, and threats. Force, fraud, coercion, these are all ways in which the commercial sex acts are forced. This particular bill, SB 165, is designed to do five things. First, it increases the penalties for sex trafficking and human trafficking in our state because these problems are issues that need to be appropriately addressed. Second, it moves sex trafficking to the chapter in Title 11 that deals with person crimes. Right now it's in a different section of the statutes where it doesn't really make sense. These crimes are really affronts against individuals and therefore should be grouped with the person crimes. Third, it closes gaps in our elements. We do have statutes on the books right now. Don't be mistaken. We do have statutes that address both human trafficking and sex trafficking. But there are elements that are missing from those statutes to allow us to respond in the most effective manner to these types of crimes. Fourth, it creates a complementary framework between both human trafficking and sex trafficking that is a little jumbled at the moment. This would bring them closer together and allow them to complement one another. And fifth and finally, it creates a method to remove or to vacate a conviction for a person that is a victim of sex trafficking when they've been convicted of prostitution. That's one of the significant things that the bill does. I told you that this is a crime that's often underreported. In Alaska, the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, who hands out money to various shelters around the state, contacted those shelters, and we found that between 2016 and 2019, there was a 115% increase in individuals that were in the shelters that voluntarily reported they had been victims of this type of a crime. The Alaska Native Justice Center in 2018 indicated that they had worked with 125 victims of sex trafficking in just that year. And an organization called Priceless in Anchorage that also works around the state has indicated they have already helped over 150 survivors get out of the trade and move on to have a better life. These are just examples of some of what's already out there. But remember, I told you that this is all often underreported. Perhaps what's most alarming to all of us is that of all the victims that I just described and all those organizations that we contacted, more than 50% of the victims are always Alaska Native. So when you're starting to deal with something like missing and murdered Indigenous persons, you have to ask yourself, how much does this particular crime play into those things? We don't know the answers to that yet, but passing a bill like this allows us to get more engaged and to ensure that we are able to respond appropriately to these problems in our state. Those are essentially the opening remarks that I have for you all, and unless there are any questions, I'm going to move on to the sectional analysis for you.
Do we have any questions for members of the committee? Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Please proceed with the sectional analysis.
Section 1 is really just a conforming change in statutes. The statute there had already addressed sex trafficking. This just makes the adjustment because the sex trafficking has moved from one section of the statutes to the other, so it's nothing more than a conforming amendment. Section number 2 is where we rework the framework for sex trafficking. We move it into section 41, and we set up 3 levels of sex trafficking. Think of it in this way. Sex trafficking in the first degree is designed to deal with the most egregious traffickers, those that use force or the threat of force, those that are trafficking persons under the age of 20, or those that traffic someone for whom they are a legal guardian. It also includes the idea of the operation of a prostitution enterprise or a place of prostitution, because those are also ways in which sex trafficking or the promotion of prostitution is accelerated, because those are situations in which there are more than one person utilizing the enterprise or that place. The second degree really addresses the recruiter or a less serious trafficker. This is one that's designed to address those people who recruit, entice, induce, or cause with the intent of promoting. These are the folks that engage in that activity through the use of fraud or coercion, not necessarily force. The third degree really deals with the facilitators. Facilitators are those people who provide services or resources or other assistance in furtherance of. And this particular concept is one that we've drawn from other states. That particular section is one that we've borrowed from New Jersey. Last but not least, in Section 2, there's also a crime that addresses the patrons of sex trafficking. Because what best practices tell us is that If you only address the supply side and fail to address the demand side, you will not effectively be able to combat this problem. And so it creates a new crime that is a patron of a victim of sex trafficking when they are reckless that the person that they are seeking to purchase sex from is a victim of sex trafficking, that would turn it into this particular crime. And there's a difference in the penalty between whether or not you're dealing with an adult or someone that's under the age of 18. Then we move on to sections 3 through 7. These are really dealing with human trafficking. Human trafficking follows the same framework as did the sex trafficking, in that you have the first degree dealing with the most egregious types, where there is human trafficking or labor trafficking through the use of force for someone that's under the age of 20 or something of that nature. Then you move on to human trafficking in the second degree. This is really the recruiter or a least serious trafficker for human trafficking. And this is with the intent to promote that you recruit, entice, induce, or cause. It lays out a number of more specific ways that deals with things like confidential information, passport or immigration documents, things of these nature that are used to induce or entice someone to engage in labor trafficking. And then the third degree really is one that addresses, again, the facilitator, the person that is dealing with the services, resources, or other assistance. Section 8 is all about the definitions, where adult entertainment, a commercial sex conduct, a place or an enterprise, services, resources, or other assistance, and sexual conduct, sexual contact, sexual penetration, and a victim of sex trafficking are all defined. Section 9 deals with the crime of coercion and makes it clear that coercion other than that coercion that's involved in sex trafficking or human trafficking is covered by this statute. But if it's human or sex trafficking, you really need to go to the other statutes for that. Section 10 is really just cleaning up the prostitution statute in the sense that it is designed to conform with the new statute numbers for human trafficking. Section 11 is also conforming in the sense that it addresses the patron for a victim under the age of 18. Section 12 is the definition of sexual conduct, and it indicates that it should be the same for both prostitution and sex trafficking. Sections 13 through 19, again, are all just conforming language to address the change in the statute number for these particular offenses. Section 20 deals with sentencing for human trafficking, placing it at an unclassified level, making the range a 5 to 99. Section 21 deals with sentencing for sex trafficking, not human trafficking. One of the ways in which the penalties are increased is that sex trafficking, under current law, is not actually considered a sex crime. Sex trafficking is not considered a sex crime under current law. This would address that. In our statutes under 1255.125 subsection I, that's the provision that specifically deals with sex crimes and provides enhanced penalties for them. This would place sex trafficking in all degrees in that location. Sections 22 and 23 deal with sex trafficking and the patron being added to the definition of a sexual felony. Section 24 addresses the definition of a serious offense and is conforming in that sense as well. Section 25 adds these sex offenses to the sex offender registry. Again, under current law, sex trafficking does not require somebody to register as a sex offender. This bill would correct that in Section 25. Section 26 deals with the vacation of the judgment of a conviction for prostitution when the individual can demonstrate that that conviction occurred because they were actually the victim of trafficking. If someone is forcing you to engage in that behavior, this really wasn't something that you engaged in of your own free will. Those people should not be saddled with a conviction for that. And so this section creates something new in Alaska law, the ability to have that completely removed from your record. Sections 27 deals with the adding of sex trafficking as a crime that is a victim of sex trafficking as being eligible for compensation from the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. Sections 29 and 28 are conforming languages dealing with obtaining a license for a school bus driver or the Landlord-Tenant Act where sex trafficking is mentioned. And Section 30, again, following along with the theme of Section 26, addresses PFDs. If you were previously convicted of prostitution and that resulted in you being ineligible for PFD for that or any following years, Section 30 reverses that so that you are now eligible and can receive the PFD if you would be eligible with the removal of just that conviction. 31 through 34 sections are all conforming sections, again, just dealing with the different location and statute. Section 35 deals with the repealers. Section 36 is the applicability, and Section 37 is simply the effective date.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Do we have questions from committee members? And before we go on to that, I would also like to note that we have Lieutenant Michael Ingram from the Department of Public Safety online. We have Catherine Monfrida and Renee McFarland all available for questions. Do we have any questions from committee members? Senator Coghill.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for bringing the bill forward. New concept in here, and that is the customer that is buying the services will now be charged. Do they also, I get that we're doing that. Do they also have to sign up on the sex registry if they're convicted?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, thank you for that question. The patron of a victim of sex trafficking is a new crime, but it also is, there's something already found in statute for a patron of prostitution. This is trying to broaden that concept and say if it's a victim of sex trafficking. The patron of a prostitution still exists on the books. That does not require registry under current law. The patron of a sex trafficking victim would require registry under the law. Yes.
Thank you. I knew there was something new here, and I
yes.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I might discourage a few.
Questions? I guess maybe I have a question for Lieutenant Ingram. Lieutenant Ingram, are you there? And if you are, I guess I'm curious from the perspective of the state troopers, what are your thoughts on this bill, pros and cons, if you could put yourself on the record and just give us your opinion.
Yeah, this is Lieutenant Mike Ingram. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the name of the person asking the question.
Senator Rivak.
Through the chair, Senator Rivak. The bill that is being discussed with you today by Mr. Skidmore, we're finding that the Johns or the patrons of the industry are essentially getting a pass because the most that we are able to ever charge them with are B-class misdemeanors for prostitution. We think that this is a pretty good solution to put a heavier hammer on those that are patrons of the industry. So it's kind of another way to cut into this industry by going after the folks that feed it, which are the folks that go out and seek commercial sex workers and industry. So, yes, we are very much in support of this particular bill for that reason.
Thank you, Lieutenant Ingram. Any other questions from members of the committee? Senator Coghill.
I just want it to be clear. The question I asked is because we're talking about a patron who is dealing with somebody who's under duress or underage, right?
That's correct.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thank you, Mr. Skidmore, Lieutenant Ingram, Ms. Monfrida, and Ms. McFarland, we appreciate you being available to answer questions. This time we're going to hold this bill for further consideration, and I'd like to again remind folks that you can submit testimony at ssta@akleg.gov. With that, we're going to wrap this meeting up, and I'd like to let everybody know that our next Senate State Affairs meeting will be held this Thursday, March 5th at 3:30 p.m. The agenda will include SB 133, sexual assault examination kits testing, SB 97, art in public buildings and facilities, SB 183, abandoned vehicles, private property, and SCR 11, Decoration of Honor Award for Gabrielle Conde. Thank you all for attending. This meeting is adjourned at 4:26 p.m.